From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. This week on Intersection, we're talking with the mayor of Columbia, Brian Treese. Mayor Treese was elected in April of this year, and now we're touching base with him on everything from what a mayor does to downtown development to police and fire services. Can you tell me a little bit about what it's like to be the mayor of Columbia? I feel like we all think we kind of know what a mayor does, but I'm not sure that many of us really understand the day-to-day workings of the office.
When I find out for sure, I'll let you know. But, you know, so far it's been a great experience. I always knew it'd be a lot of work. I was surprised with how much fun it's been, and it's really been a great professional challenge. You know, a lot of people see their mayor on, you know, our city council meetings, which are every other Monday, and if that's all I had to do was preside over that bi-monthly meeting, I'd be very happy. But there's a lot of activity during the week as well. I mean, I can give you a typical day, and I try to be very transparent about my schedule. You know, on council Mondays, I usually start on the radio at 8:30, have a standing meeting at 9 o'clock. I meet with another city council member at 10 about that night's agenda. Usually have a lunch meeting out downtown somewhere with, you know, a group or constituents. Typically meet with the city manager that afternoon. We often have a closed work session at 5 o'clock, a pre-council meeting at 6, and then the regular council meeting at 7. But, you know, like this weekend, for example, we had a free basketball clinic with the men's and women's basketball team at Mizzou in Douglas Park. We had the first architectural salvage sale. And, of course, historic preservation is one of my, you know, loves, pet projects. And, you know, try to be active and create connections not only with our community but the university community and try to meet with as many people as I can.
So being mayor is a full-time job.
It could certainly be a full-time job, and of course I'm, you know, have a regular job as well, and I try to balance both of those along with family and work and try to be effective and you know, fortunately, you know, Columbia has a strong council manager form of government. So as far as the day-to-day activities of running a city, we're in very good hands with the city staff that work very hard, you know, on public works and law enforcement and all of those issues that go into running a full-service city like the city of Columbia. I think what the mayor and together with the council does is help set policy at a high level of how do we want Columbia to grow? What is the direction for our city? What is our vision for the city in the next 10, 20, 30 years? And try to set the tone of and high expectations for how we grow, how we live, how we make Columbia, you know, unique and safe and a great place to work and play and live.
And so are the people you work most closely with, the city manager, Mike Mathis, and the other members of the city council?
I meet with the city manager regularly and of course, meet with other council members, especially if there's something going on in their ward or, you know, the city council meeting produces a long to-do list. And I want to make sure that staff is staying on top of that and following through and getting council members the information they need to make good decisions. And, you know, I've been very pleased with how that has worked, and I think it helps make my time more efficient and hopefully yields superior results for the city.
So there's a strong collaborative working relationship in the council at this time?
Oh, of course, yeah. There's a great balance between the council and staff and the council and the city manager, and I think we have a great city council that, you know, is not only effectively represents the very diverse population in Columbia, but also represents the, you know, the disparate geography within Columbia when it comes to the needs of the 1st Ward or the 6th Ward or the 5th Ward. And, you know, as mayor, I try to look at each of those decisions independently and think, what's the best public policy? What's fair to everyone involved?
Before the election, I know that downtown development was a huge issue. It's obviously something you're really familiar with. And there's a perception among a lot of people that we've spoken with that downtown development is about students and it's only good for students and that it's taxing the infrastructure for the rest of us. What's changed since your election as mayor in terms of downtown development?
Well, in fact, I think it was those symptoms that probably propelled my victory in, mm-hmm. in April, and that was one of the reasons at my first meeting I asked for a administrative delay on new development downtown, particularly those, you know, student-centric luxury high-rises that I do believe tax our infrastructure, that, you know, void opportunities for retail and small businesses in Columbia that take up parking spaces for the rest of the community that wants to come to downtown Columbia to worship, to shop, to dine. And I thought it was important that we take a pause, take a deep breath and look at, you know, what are those you know, what are those issues that we need to address head on? And that was one of the reasons, obviously, we have the Planning and Zoning Commission right now looking at a new downtown overlay to really update Columbia's zoning laws for the first time in 50 years. I appointed a new chairman of the Mayor's Infrastructure Task Force to really look at who pays for the costs of the increased demand on our infrastructure like water and sewer and stormwater and electrical capacity. I created and appointed a new Parking and Traffic Management Task Force to look at the demands of parking downtown. How can we provide ample parking opportunities? How can we incentivize private developers that are creating additional demand with, you know, 400, 500 beds at a time, you know, many of whom will bring their cars with them to downtown Columbia to live? And then asking Historic Preservation to come up with a list issues that can help us protect what's left of downtown. And hopefully all four of those panels and task forces will bring their recommendations to council before the end of the year, before our administrative delay, our six-month temporary administrative delay expires, so that we can really get it right. And because I know there's a lot of demand. I think, you know, what was important to me was that the city my concern was the city was inadvertently contributing to a housing bubble downtown by subsidizing infrastructure, subsidizing parking requirements. And I want to make sure that if the enrollment at MU declines, that we're not left with a bunch of vacant, single-purpose-built luxury student high-rises that, you know, create additional demand on our infrastructure.
Was it difficult to get council to agree to the delay?
It was not. No, it passed. I think it passed 5-2, if not 6-1. But I think everybody probably supports the opportunity to have the benefit of time without the pressure of development backing up on us to really get this right. Because if we don't get it right now, you know, we're going to forfeit you know, the opportunity to really build a Columbia and protect a downtown that really makes us unique from other communities.
And I notice, obviously, anybody looking around downtown sees that buildings are still being built right now. Did the delay affect the approval of new projects?
Well, there were some projects that were already in the pipeline that had already requested building permits, and those were not affected. And, you know, I don't know that there have been – I don't know that there – and to be clear, there is a mechanism that if they want to seek council approval to move forward with that project, there's certainly a mechanism to do that. What I did not want to do was continue that open-ended C2 zoning where you can tear down a single-story retail establishment and go back with an 11-story, you know, all residential with no retail on the first floor, no parking requirement, you know, all of those things that I think were frustrating, you know, people that have either grown up in Columbia or come to Columbia and fall in love with our downtown.
And can you explain what an overlay is? I've heard it talked about in terms of the Benton Stevens area.
Well, it's another level of protection within Columbia's existing zoning framework that would allow a majority of property owners to get together and say, this is what we want our neighborhood, in the case of Benton Stevens, to look like in terms of the setback of houses from the sidewalk or the orientation of front porches or, you know, being able to protect, you know, the historic character and feel of that neighborhood. And one of the solutions that zoning consultants recommended was the creation of a similar downtown overlay, or this the ability to really look at how we want Columbia to grow into the future by preserving some predictability for developers, but also some flexibility that they don't have to come to planning and zoning every time or the city council every time, that they meet the characteristics of what we want Columbia to look like.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM, and we're talking with Columbia Mayor Brian Treese. When our Intersection team was downtown asking people for their questions for the mayor, they met Norma Spurgeon. Her specific question is, how is the construction affecting our sewer systems and the availability of parking? So it sounds like you've got a task force looking at parking. What are the thoughts about the sewage systems?
Well, right now you can see the Flat Branch Relief Sewer is going in right now. That's all that construction there on the Katy Trail. There is a huge swath of trees removed for that to build a new line into downtown. And I know there's at least two of those, you know, almost whole block developments that will tap into that new sewer line. Now, the challenge will be, will that line be complete and operational before the occupancy permit of those new buildings are? And so I think that's the race against time that is being created right now. And on the parking side, you know, I think that's, we have a parking and traffic management task force, and there's a great divide between, you know, do you force developers to build a parking spot for each bed that they're creating? Mm-hmm. Is there that much demand for it? Or do you try to incentivize what's called mode shift by, well, if you don't build any parking spots and if there's no place to park, people just won't bring their cars and they'll walk everywhere. I'm probably more aligned with the former because I just think it's unrealistic that people are going to, you know, come to Columbia and you know, rent a $1,200 a month apartment and not have a car. Right. And
there's a real car culture in the Midwest.
There is, yeah. And, you know, that being said, there's probably we may not have a car parking problem as much as we have a car storage problem. Mm. Because some of those students may not need their car during the week because they are walking from downtown to campus. But on Saturdays, they need it to go home or go to the grocery store or wherever it may be. And so I've encouraged that parking and traffic management task force to really look at all of those issues. But, you know, it's that downtown issue that, you know, has really got our downtown churches involved, and they've asked to participate on that parking and traffic management task force. They're running shuttles for their downtown churchgoers on Sunday mornings to get to church and have a place to park. We did have a smart growth parking audit of not just downtown, but in some of the neighborhoods around downtown, and they found that we have negative excess capacity, meaning not only was every parking spot full, but cars were also parking at the yellow no parking zones. Uh-huh. And, you know, particularly in neighborhoods like East Campus and the Old Southwest, those are narrow streets to begin with. It really creates a fire protection challenge to get a snozzle truck down, you know, some of these old streets if cars are parking on both sides of the street. So, you know, public safety needs to be our number one priority, but there's also the convenience and you know, some of that shared responsibility of making sure that everybody has an opportunity to enjoy downtown.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM, and we're talking with Columbia Mayor Brian Treese. Our team met some people as they were leaving the library to go buy a car and asked them if they had any questions. Ah, yes, it's Paul Vann and Joe Purdy. So they didn't have a car and they were on their way to buy a car because they just felt like the bus system wasn't workable for them, especially with the weekend hours, and they were wondering if there are any plans to increase bus service.
Yeah, and there are, and part of that is just a financial metric in that we need the density to be able to afford to run those buses on the weekends. And one of the things that I have done within the capital improvements budget is to make sure that we have a plan to acquire and build bus shelters along those prominent routes. I mean, it's frustrating to me to see, you know, shoppers at Lucky's holding their grocery bags, sitting in the dirt, waiting for that city bus to come. Or, you know, same can be said of Hy-Vee and that intersection down there. And, you know, we really can't expect people to take the bus to go to the mall or put on a suit and tie to go to a job interview if they have to go stand in the rain waiting for a bus to come. So we need to make sure that bus system is timely and predictable. And I also think, you know, people don't want to just ride the bus between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. They're going to want to take it to the movies on the weekends or home from a football game or, you know, to worship on Sundays, you know, and really make that bus system a little more robust to meet the demands of the population that it's intended to serve. And I think, you know, the good news is with data points now and GPS, we can figure out where is the population that wants to ride this bus and what are the best times of day that we can help create some optimum ridership within those within that system.
So do you think there's the hope of seeing more bus service in the coming year?
I hope so. And, you know, we just received a federal grant to acquire some more buses, natural gas buses, mm-hmm. that are great for the environment. And hopefully, you know, I would love to be able to have a bus system that is efficient and predictable and goes to those commonly accessible routes that we all want. I think you'd probably get a non-traditional bus rider, someone who is willing to leave their car at home and walk, you know, to a bus stop, knowing that they can get somewhere within 15 minutes at a very attractive price, and know that when they're done shopping, they have another immediate path home, whether that's dinner or the mall or, you know, the grocery store.
I wanted to talk a little bit about inequality in Colombia, also another topic that's been under discussion a lot. And in July, obviously, there was a lot of violence in the country surrounding police forces. And you talked about how in Colombia we know that there is a direct correlation between social unrest and inequality. What is the mayor's office working on in terms of identifying and addressing inequality here?
Yeah. And, you know, first of all, I think we have to pay attention to the symptoms that, you know, led to the Ferguson tragedy 2 years ago, as well as Baton Rouge and Philando Castile in Minneapolis. And, you know, Colombia is not immune to those issues, and we have to address those issues head on, whether that's our racial profiling statistics. And I've asked the city manager to work with the police chief to initiate a dialogue about why those statistics are occurring and to make sure that all of our police officers have the diversity training they need to look to themselves for implicit bias in how those stops are procured. And I think the other thing that we can do is really make this social equity a centerpiece in our decision making when it comes to both infrastructure investments, law enforcement investments. We've got a very robust community policing program being developed right now and really developing those relationships within the law enforcement community and three targeted neighborhoods that, you know, are seeing higher incidence of crime and higher incidence of unrest. And I'm very proud of our law enforcement officers. I was with them twice this weekend, one at a basketball clinic in Douglas Park, and then again yesterday at the dedication of our joint 911 center. And I'm so proud of our men and women in the police department for the relationships that they're building and the seriousness and patience that they bring to their job to protect and serve the people in our community.
And there definitely were some sort of tense moments in Colombia over the summer. There was a report released by the Police Officers Association that was very critical of the policing situation in Colombia. It was in some places critical of the city manager. It was in other places critical of the schedules and of being understaffed. And it said the morale was low. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're talking with the police about?
Absolutely. And those issues are not new. And if anything, they have probably come to a head, especially after Baton Rouge and the murder of law enforcement officers in Dallas. Mm-hmm. I can tell you we've lost probably 3, 4, 5 police officers to other jobs, mm-hmm. outside the law enforcement community. And these are veteran police officers. I can tell you one law enforcement officer told me that he was going to go work at Dollar General Warehouse in Fulton, Missouri, because the pay is about the same. He heard they had spontaneous employee appreciation days there, and his wife didn't worry about him when he went to work. Now, it's pretty hard to change the culture of the police department to address those issues, but I think we can recognize the strain that that stress puts on families. We have a 12-hour shift now, and I dare say that any of us in the 11th hour of our 12-hour day probably doesn't have the same enthusiasm or energy or patience or to do their job when they were as fresh at 7 a.m. that morning. And, you know, it's compounded by the fact that they're missing dinner with their family or they're missing their son's baseball game or, you know, all of those issues. So I do think that we can be a little more creative in how we take care of our police officers and how that in turn is going to create better results within the police department.
And there were also some city meetings where I think the police chief called into question whether there is actually racial profiling going on in Columbia. And that was met with some anger and some real upset by different citizens. Has that conversation moved forward?
It has. It continues to move forward. I think the police chief has now adopted a bit of a more open mind to look into the factors that lead to those incidents. And, you know, that dialogue is ongoing. And I've asked the city manager to initiate a more public discussion with all interested parties, you know, in that community and across the entire community as to, you know, how our police department is managed and what are the factors that go into those stops. And, you know, but I think you have to pay attention to that data. The Attorney General's office clearly says we have a racial profiling problem in Columbia. And, you know, I think that has to be acknowledged and look at the factors that go into those stops instead of just saying, no, it doesn't exist. And so fortunately, I do think that that conversation is occurring right now.
And we talked with another person here in Columbia who's Lamarian Allen, and he's worried about safety. He lives in North Columbia, and he's asking about plans for reducing crime and keeping Columbia safe for kids. I know that when we first spoke, we talked about the police force and also the fire department being sort of overtaxed and being stretched thin and talked about hiring more police officers. What's happening on that front?
Sure. And I mean, I think everyone can agree that our police department and our fire department is understaffed. And one of the things that that I will do in next week's budget session is have an amendment to, we'll be able to add about 3.5 or 4 police officers by moving some street maintenance money around from our operating budget to our capital improvements budget, and that will free up some ongoing general revenue that will immediately support 3 to 4 new police officers. I think that also is going to help with that schedule of moving from 12-hour shifts to a 10-hour shift that really gives police officers the respite that they need, you know, off work with their family and help them do a better job when they're at work. But yes, I think the ongoing needs of the police department for a town the size of Columbia is going to continue to be a problem. And, you know, part of the solution to improving morale in the police department is having more police officers, more backup, having 2 officers to a car. And you can't do that without additional staff. And that's what I've been trying to do through the budget process. And I think that will be an ongoing issue throughout my term.
So these police officers would actually grow the total police force, taking into account that some people have left the force. Bringing on this money means that the force would actually,
absolutely,
the net force would grow.
Yeah, it would be a net gain of 4 police officers. And where we have vacancies and attrition there, we'd one of the first things that I did at our meeting was to eliminate the hiring freeze on new police and fire recruits. I mean, it's hard enough to recruit a police officer, put them through the training academy, only to say you're going to have to wait 45 days before you become official. That's the window that they're more apt to go to second guess. Should I go to another city? Should I even stay in this profession at all? And I think the same is true for firefighters. I was proud to speak at a graduation ceremony for 4 new fire recruits. And if you asked me what it's like to be mayor, that is one of the most humbling and meaningful and moving jobs that I have to do is to visit with our first responders, our those 4 fire recruits and the police officers that are putting their lives on the line every day.
And there are a lot of other things going on around Colombia, like the airport and medical tourism. Anything else that you're excited about right now?
Well, I was very excited to appoint a medical tourism task force last week. And, you know, I think Colombia is unique that we have, you know, healthcare is a major part of Colombia's growing economy. And, you know, we have several hospitals here, several subspecialties like oncology, Ellis Fischel, orthopedic care, a fantastic vet school that, you know, attracts patients from across the country here. And I think there's a real opportunity to put, you know, the leaders of the healthcare community in a room and say, what can the city do to help market Colombia as this regional healthcare destination for people that want to come here for cancer care or orthopedic care, heart disease? And so we've put the leaders of Boone Hospital and MU Healthcare and our orthopedic center and Ellis Fischel and Truman VA and as well as our hoteliers, leaders in the hotel community to figure out, you know, how, because, you know, a lot of these patients come here for 3-day surgeries and recoveries and their families come with them to care for them. And I think this is a major part of what could differentiate Colombia on into the future. And I think the new airport terminal is part of that. The other thing that I was very proud of to do in the first few months of my term was adopt a new culture of transparency. I asked for the council to join me in adopting a transparency policy that really sets high expectations that when the city receives a request for public information, those requests are dealt with as expeditiously as possible to really meet not just the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law and recent case law. And I'm proud to say that we're going to be taking additional steps to really make sure that our meetings are not only open to the public, but promoted to the public, and that, you know, information that taxpayers want and that have already paid for to get the data or the reports or the minutes of those meetings will be using technology in a better way to make that information more accessible to the public. And, you know, I think Colombia is unique, but I think the presence of the premier school of journalism in the country really gives Colombia as a city, the honor and the impetus to really be as open as possible and transparent in how we do business and making sure that our government is as open and honest as possible.
And anybody can go to the city council meetings.
Oh, of course. You know, every other Monday, first and third Mondays on of each month. Our council meetings start at 7 o'clock. The agenda is posted online the Thursday before, so everybody has an opportunity to go through. And we have a very robust public comment period. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, we'll have public comment for 30 minutes before the meeting starts, and then, of course, on all the public hearings. And then at the end of the meeting is another opportunity for unscheduled public comment. And I think that's one of the things that makes Colombia great, is that we have a lot of sophisticated you know, opinion leaders that bring their ideas to Colombia, and that often, you know, triggers the additional questions in the council to ask as to how we're reaching the decisions we have, and I think that's part of what makes Colombia great.
Thanks for joining Intersection for our conversation with Colombia Mayor Brian Treece. I want to thank our producers, Mary McIntyre, Sophia Zhang, Molly Olmsted, Rachel Foster Gimble, and Danielle Hogarty. And of course, thank you to Mayor Treece and all the people around town who contributed their questions and opinions to this show. Please tune in next week as we learn about the Blind Boone House, which opened this month. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection here on KBIA 91.3 FM.